First case on our calendar, 08-894, Jonathan Klaus versus United Equity. Mr. Ram.
Mr. Chief Justice, it may please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Brian Ram, and I have the pleasure of representing United Equity here today for this appeal. If I could, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there in the clock.
Thank you. We're here today for, I think, two reasons. One reason is I want to urge the court to reverse the decision from the third district and reinstate the trial court's decision in favor of my client. Secondly, we are dealing with a statute in a case of first impression, Revised Code 274501. And I think this would be a wonderful opportunity to give guidance to the bench and bar in the state of Ohio. Normally, and I've read the pamphlet on presenting to the Supreme Court, normally I'd be a little brief on the facts, but I believe that inferred intent, intentional tort cases are fact specific. So I'd like to run through a few of the facts, if I may. In this particular case, United Equity operates a grain and feed facility in Spencerville, Ohio. Essentially, there are three employees there. There's a general manager and then an overseer, so at most five employees. And if you've seen in the record, in the 23 years of operation in the Spencerville facility, there has never been an industrial accident.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
When did this accident happen?
This accident occurred.
Not day, time of day.
Morning.
Start of work, close to it?
And the best I have is it was in the morning. They were about to start up work.
And the vertical auger wouldn't work because the shear pins had been broken sometime before. Is that right, or was this?
To the best of my recollection, it must have occurred the night before, but from that morning, one of the employees realized, hey, we've got to get those repaired before we start up today.
Okay. And at the time that the plaintiff went up to the third floor.
Yes, sir.
So that would have been toward the start of work. I believe I read in your fact statement that all of the power levers are shut off every night.
Yes.
Yeah. But you claim, what I'm getting at is this seems to me to be very fact specific, and the Court of Appeals didn't attack the statute. They just said there's enough here to get past summary.
Well, I think the Court of Appeals.
Right.
Well, the Court of Appeals referenced the statute and then went right into a Fife analysis.
Okay.
So I don't know exactly what deference they did or did not give the statute.
Okay, but here's, you suggest that one comes in and if the power is engaged or is disengaged, that means that somebody's up on the third floor in a dangerous situation, right?
Well, my argument is when the lever is down and the power is disengaged, by the on-the-job training provided by the general manager, the rule of thumb is you find out why the power level's down.
Right.
You're assuming that someone's
working.
Okay,
the problem with that argument is that you also say in your brief that every night before they go home, they pull all the power levers down. So the power level's down may just mean it's morning and it's time to flip them up. It doesn't mean, by the statement of facts in your own brief, that somebody's up on the third floor, beware.
Now, with respect, in this particular case, the levers were up.
Right.
They should have been pushed down.
Down
to go work on the auger. Mr. Klaus testified that on that particular day, he didn't put the lever down because he was in a hurry to fix the bolts, and that he asked a co-worker to keep an eye on the power for him.
Okay, when the guy who pushed the fatal button came back in.
Yeah, that was the different coworker.
Right. Right. What machines were running?
Well, in this particular facility, you have to use that. You have to use that auger. If you know how a feed mix setup. I mean, you have to use that auger to move the grain.
Well, let me help you out. The mixer's running because Right. You just said they were unloading the feed truck into the mixer. So the mixer's running. Is the grinder running?
That I don't know, and I don't know if that was ever brought out in deposition.
But there would be, if the mixer's running, there's a lot of noise.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so a guy comes in. What I'm getting at is, who on earth would think it's all right to send someone up to the third floor to put his hands in the auger without locking out the power?
Well, Your Honor, for the 23 years prior, pulling down and disconnecting the power level had worked close to 100 times.
Nothing had happened.
And that's correct. In this particular case, unfortunately, Mr. Klaus did not pull down the lever.
But
the
proper safety procedure is lock it out, is it not?
Well, there are two safety procedures. We've got the rule of thumb that's followed at the facility that had worked for 23 years without incident.
But that rule of thumb represents enormous risk to anybody who's on the third floor and out of communication with people on the first floor.
Well, I think that goes into the heart of the statute, where we're talking about substantial certainty of injury and deliberate intent. When you're talking about enormous risk, we also have to look at whether or not an injury from that risk is virtually certain or substantially certain to occur. My argument here and my argument in the briefs has been that in 23 years there had not been a prior incident where anyone's had sustained injury.
Is that to be the test for intentional torts under the new statute? If it hasn't happened in the last 23 years, it's not an intentional tort.
Well, it's our suggestion that the language of the new statute with deliberate intent, the conscious awareness of this enormous risk of injury, virtually making the injury substantially certain to occur. All right? Our argument is this deliberate intent, by definition, you have to have knowledge on behalf of the employer that the procedures that had been in place and had been working don't work and caused injury.
My point is, on the facts of this case, and that's where the Court of Appeals went, on the facts, they said, you get the summary. On the facts of this case, the only way to be substantially certain that there isn't enormous risk to somebody on the third floor, out of sight, out of hearing, working on this auger, is to lock it out so that nobody can come along. You've got four different people that work there, any one of whom can come in and flip the lever and engage it without the person up top knowing. The only way to be certain that enormous risk isn't present is to lock it out. And the Court of Appeals said that's a jury question.
Well, I understand what the Court of Appeals said, and I respectfully suggest that the Court of Appeals was looking only at the Fife decision as opposed to the new statute. But I understand what you're saying is, when you're saying it's a lockout, tag out, that's definitive. You know, so be it. Every industrial accident, every workplace accident, there was an issue. You know, there was some issue as to a breach of some safety protocol. Every single one. I mean, I virtually can't think of an accident that doesn't occur that way. So then what we're left to look at, now we're going to be looking at, gee, was this negligence, was this recklessness, was this wantonness, or now are we getting into that point where we can actually infer intent for an intentional tort in the workplace?
Well, the test is, isn't it, Mr. Ram, that injury is substantially certain to occur. That's really what you're talking about in intentional tort, isn't it?
Right. So we're
and
focusing
it's the knowledge
on,
by the employer that that will happen, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's knowledge by the employer that injury is substantially certain to occur.
Correct.
Are you suggesting that under this statute, with the definition of deliberate intent, that we no longer apply substantial certainty torts because the employer must have actual knowledge, or you're not going that far?
Well, I'm suggesting that the term deliberate intent to in B, Section B, to define substantial certainty in Section A goes to the point where you now have a conscious awareness that your procedure, okay, we're not necessarily looking at the risk of someone putting their hand in an auger. We're looking at the procedure of having somebody work on the auger with the power level down. Okay? That's what we're concentrating on to determine whether or not there's going to be a substantial certainty of injury. And within that deliberate intent, I'm saying there has to be some knowledge on the part of the employer, you know, be it through prior injury using the same procedure, close calls, awareness that in other facilities this procedure doesn't work, and that knowledge has been then somehow communicated to the employer. There are a number of ways that we can get to that level of conscious awareness that it's substantially certain to occur. What I'm arguing in this particular case is, yes, I understand the argument that, hey, we could have made this definitive. You know, we put a deadbolt on this until the man comes down from the third floor, and I understand that. But within the context of what we're talking about here, we've got a rule of thumb that had worked for 23 years, and this injury had never occurred before.
Mr. Ram, are you suggesting that the first accident is always immune from being considered deliberate intent?
You know, I gave that a lot of thought, and I hearken back to the dog bite cases, the old days of one bite, this and that. You know, I don't necessarily think that's correct. What I'm saying is that the actual knowledge is, it could be this actual knowledge that the employer has from there might be a sister company or within the industry that's now imparted to, you know, a general manager or the owner saying, look, you know, this particular system that we're using has caused injury in Toledo or Youngstown or other places. We've got to shore this up and change our safety policies. What I'm saying is, in this particular case, looking at the past history record, I don't think that gets up the sliding scale of beyond wanton misconduct and then just short of intentional misconduct, you know, hitting somebody over the head with a bat.
Let me explore it a different way. The actual knowledge that your client had is that if the lever's up, the power's engaged, and the only way to make sure the power doesn't get engaged is to have it locked down. And the employer knows that. The employer also knows there are five people who come in here, see the levers down every morning because they put them down the night before, and they flip them up when it either first thing in the morning or they flip them up as they need those power to those machines. So the levers go up for two reasons. One, to indicate there's under their tradition that they're done doing work, and the second is it's time to go to work. So the lever up doesn't really mean much. I'll bet after looking over this case, you wouldn't ever go to the third floor without having the power source locked out.
Well, lever down means the power is off. I mean, we're talking about we're talking about throwing an extra lock on it. Lever down, power's off. So,
but there are five people who routinely throw that lever up.
Well, in this particular case, again, the system in place, the rule of thumb that these people learned on the job, and we're really only talking about three people here. Okay, Mr. Klaus, Mr. McMichael, and Mr. O'Neill. You know, that is the rule of thumb, and that's what was measured.
I thought the other guy did the pin replacement himself sometimes.
Oh, that's the general manager, Hayne, but he's not actually, he travels around. He's not always located at the facility. I've included him in the five of the people that are there and around there, but he's not there constantly. But he would be the one to impart to these folks, hey, you know, when you're doing this, put the lever down. That's the rule of thumb in the on-the-job training.
Mr. Wright, let me ask you a legal question. Why shouldn't we, if we decide that the Court of Appeals did not apply 2745.01, applied Fife as the trial court did. Why shouldn't we reverse? If we reverse, why shouldn't we remand it to the Court of Appeals to have the Court of Appeals apply the correct statute. You are just to reinstate the trial court's judgment, which is preferable to you, obviously, your client, but.
Exactly. Well,
Court of Appeals seems to me, well, if the Court of Appeals erred in applying the wrong standard, or should we decide it here because we have as much as we need to decide whether who wins?
Well, I'd suggest that you decide it here because we're here assuming, and I know my colleague's going to be discussing the question of whether or not the statute's actually constitutional. However, should that occur, should it be constitutional? I presume we'll have hopefully some good guidance and direction from this court that if you wanted to send it back to the third appellate district, so be it. But I'd suggest that this case, and I think the facts that presented to this honorable court, it could be decided here. And I see my, yes. I believe my time is up.
Yes, the red light means. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Roemer.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, please the court. I'd like to respond to a couple of questions that the justices have posed to Mr. Ramp before I get into my main thrust of argument. The first thing is the time of the incident was first thing in the morning. Mr. McMichael had gone out to unload, if you will, a truck, put it back in the mixer. They had mixed grain the day before and made the wrong mix.
Counsel, before we talk about this, or you address the facts here, I'd like to follow up on the Chief's question. Clearly, the Court of Appeals, I think, assumed that Fife and analyzed this under the criterion set forth in Fife and didn't focus on the language of the statute that focuses the statute that deliberate intent takes into account substantially certain to occur, which means a deliberate intent to cause an employee to suffer an injury. Because the Court of Appeals employed Fife as opposed to a detailed analysis of the statute and then applying the statute to the facts, and again, I don't think that there's too much of a dispute about the facts here, we need a legal remedy here, or this court to address that, not necessarily whether it was in the morning or whether the switch was up or the switch was down. Don't you agree that this needs to be re-examined under the appropriate statute?
Thank you for that question, because I didn't know how I was going to get to that until the Chief asked the question.
That was pretty easy to get there, wasn't it?
Yeah. My response is we pled this as a Fife case, assuming from the very beginning the constitutionality of the statute. And the reasoning of that is in the third and fourth assignments of error argued to the Court of Appeals. Those are that 2745.01a is an immunity statute and nothing else. It's an affirmative defense, was not pled, and is not involved in the case. The Court of Appeals never talked about that. Secondly, that the definition in the second branch of 2745.01a, that is, the belief that it was substantially certain to occur, is a lesser standard than Fife. Fife requires actual knowledge or knowledge. Belief is a lesser mental state, if you will. And if you analyze it and analogize it to criminal law, which I think I did in the brief, knowledge is a much higher standard than just the belief that something's going to happen.
So the appellate court then has the option of either analyzing it under Fife or under the statute?
I believe that they have to analyze, my personal belief is that they were required to analyze it under the statute, falling back on Fife as some of the explanations, definitions, and so forth to assist them. They did not, and found in fact those two issues, the third and fourth assignments, were moot because of what they did in one and two. So my answer to the Chief Justice would be, if the court finds the Court of Appeals did not, the Third District did not address all the issues, a remand with instructions to consider those issues would then reactivate, if you would, our third and fourth assignments of error, and we could address those at the time.
Doesn't the statute, A, the employer shall not be liable unless the plaintiff proves that the employer committed the tortious act with the intent. It seems to me the burden is on the plaintiff, is it not, to prove that the employer acted with deliberate intent? You said it's an affirmative defense. I wanted to explore that. That's an interesting.
Okay, we didn't brief it because that wasn't in the proposition. And it would not protect the judgment, so cross appeal was not appropriate.
Well, perhaps we shouldn't use your time here to discuss
That's okay. I'm happy to respond to it because I believe that you're correct, Judge Justice, as it relates to the plaintiff's burden under A, but I think there's a burden shifting when you then want to apply B to what deliberate intent is. And it's in relationship to Fife and the definitions of substantial certainty in the various cases of precedent before this court that creates that burden shifting.
I see how you're reading it.
Thank you. Now, I do want to talk about 2745.01b also, because I had some early trial court experience with Johnson versus BP Chemical. There's a statement in Johnson versus BP Chemical that I think is critical to this court's analysis of this case and this statute, and that is that based upon the application of B as the appellant is requesting, the employer must commit a criminal assault before the statute can be overcome by the plaintiff. And I can't believe, as the justice who made the comment in Johnson believed, that an employee must come into a court and prove by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And by the way, while I'm on that, in the brief filed by appellant, they specifically asked for 100% certainty that an injury was going to occur. Absolute certainty. That's even higher standard than beyond a reasonable doubt, as we've given the instruction, or many of us have given the instruction over and over again to a jury. I can't believe that a civil litigant would have to make that burden and establish a criminal intent before a cause of action would arise in an employer intentional tort matter. We have analyzed that and in our brief.
Counsel, where does it say proof beyond a reasonable doubt? You lost me there. I can understand where you might compare the intent standard to the criminal law, but I don't see any burden of proof that raises to beyond a reasonable doubt.
If, in fact, the employee is charged with the responsibility, Justice Cupp, of proving 100% certainty, and we look at the reasonable doubt jury instruction that is given to a fact finder as to what beyond a reasonable doubt means, 100% certainty is a higher burden than beyond a reasonable doubt's legal definition. That's what I mean. I happen to believe that the legislature was, in fact, writing beyond a reasonable doubt in their definition of deliberate intent as the standard. That has to be extrapolated. It doesn't say it per se in the verbiage. I want to address another point, and that is the questions asked by Justice Pfeiffer. I would suggest that any employer in today's industrial setting who does not know, or which does not know, that an energized piece of equipment being worked on by an employee is reasonably certain or substantially certain or maybe even 100% certain to injure that employee who is working on it. That is the whole basis for the lockout, tagout philosophy in industry today, that to protect the employee so that he does not or she does not have to be concerned about some third party's involvement in energizing that equipment when his hands are in it, to protect it.
Did you challenge the constitutionality of the statute at the trial court or court of appeals level?
No, Justice Stratton, we did not.
So that issue is not before us. The issue is what standard the court applied and whether it was the correct standard under the new statute. And what that standard means.
That's not the proposition before the court, but that's what I believe the case is that's before the court. That's correct.
Well, as you know, we have three cases this morning that all flush this out, but I was wondering where your stance was on that.
Believe me, I've read all that, and I'm as confused as the next person. When you put the three together, I mean.
Before you start the rest of your argument, just as a factual question, is there an OSHA investigation in this accident?
Yes,
any
sir.
OSHA rule involved? How about a specific safety rule of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation? Is that involved in this as well?
That was also taken care of, yes. There was a claim, and that claim was taken care of, yes. There's a couple other points that are raised by appellant's brief that I think this court needs to look at, if you will. And the first one is that it is not appropriate for a litigant to use an inference to prove substantial certainty. This is argued at some extent in the appellant's brief, and I'm not quite sure where it comes from, because this is a summary judgment case, of course, and the rule in and of itself says that any inferences that come from evidence, from direct evidence, should be applied in favor of the non-moving party, or in our case, Mr. Klaus, the employee. We have hundreds of cases tried every day that have inferences used to decide good evidence, and that includes cases from death penalty cases down to slip and fall cases. I believe the court's being requested by that argument to say that inferences cannot be used for Civil 56 motions in employer intentional tort cases. And I would abhor the court not to adopt such a philosophy in an intentional tort case, regardless of how the analysis comes out.
What do you believe the new statute sets as a standard?
I believe the new statute sets as a standard exactly what Fife says, but for paragraph B. Paragraph B creates this deliberate intent definition of substantial certainty. If they'd taken the, with all due respect to the legislature, had they taken the deliberate intent and put it someplace else other than a substitution for substantial certainty, it may have worked. It became a quantitative rather than a qualitative element. But when they substitute it for substantial certainty, that is, substantial certainty shall mean deliberate intent, it throws everything into a quagmire. We argue in our brief that's a redundancy, because it's in the first disjunctive in A is to injure an employee, intend to injure an employee. The second disjunctive is with the deliberate intent to injure an employee. So, with the exception of B, I think the statute clearly allows the Fife analysis to be used under the statute, with the one exception, caveat, that I've already brought to the court's attention, and that is that I believe the standard is lesser because of the word belief rather than the word knowledge in the substantial certainty issue.
Although, Mr. Roemer, the General Assembly declared its intent to substitute for the Blankenship and Fife and so on. Is that correct? I mean, it wasn't that they were attempting to lessen the standard, but to more clearly define the difference between negligence and intentional conduct, which isn't covered by the workers' comp statute.
Well, Justice Leisinger, that may be. I don't think there's any evidence of that in the testimony before the committee, but it may be that they believed they were substituting for the Fife standards. My suggestion to this court is they're charged with the responsibility of knowing what the words mean. And when they tell me as a practicing attorney that my client only needs to prove that the employer believed there was substantial certainty of an injury to occur, I'm entitled to rely upon that in prosecuting my client's case. That, to me, seems like it is a lesser standard than knowledge or actual knowledge. Let me suggest to this court that the real issue here on substantial certainty, whether it be under the statute, under Fife, or whatever, is that substantial certainty should be determined by the quality of the certainty and not the quantity of the knowledge. The quality of the certainty and not the quantity of the knowledge. Now, that might appear to fly in the face of even Fife, but by changing the statute, paragraph A of the statute, I think the legislature opened the door for that analysis. We'd ask the court to make that analysis. We'd ask the court, this court, to affirm the Third District Court of Appeals and allow Mr. Klaus to go back and have trier of fact decide the facts in this case. I'll be happy to respond to any further questions the court might have.
Thank you, Mr. Roemer.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Ram, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly in response to Mr. Roemer's comments, Johnson was dealing with a prior statute that is completely different than the one we have before us, and, you know, talking about the criminal assault intent. You know, I don't think that's what the current statute said. I think it can be read, you know, you're talking about a classic intentional tort, hitting your employee over the head with a bat because you meant to hurt that employee. You know, that's a problem, and that's a criminal assault. I understand that. But when we're talking about the inferred intent, okay, and, you know, allowing it to, you know, I think the statute is written to bypass Johnson and have it stand, you know, withstand constitutional muster. You know, I don't see anywhere in the statute that, you know, that is beyond a reasonable doubt or some type of criminal assault standard. And I do see that I'm on beyond my time, and I want to thank you very much for allowing us to come in here today.
Thank you, Mr. Ram. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.